The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Tuesday, March the 11th. I'm Mel Preen. Counting the cost of war, new figures show spending on the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq has nearly doubled.
We should have proper explanation, and the Ministry of Defence should not take the House of Commons for granted.
More heavy rains and winds look set to batter Britain for a second day. We hear from our weather-beaten reporter in Cornwall.
People are going and having a look. It's hard to resist, really. But the Coast Guard saying that's very dangerous. Please stay away.
Plus, we talk to our Beijing correspondent on why China has had a rethink on the death penalty. But before we hear about any of that, here's Sandy Waugh with today's news and the papers.
Police in Pakistan say at least 15 people were killed when two bombs were set off in the city of Lahore. One of them went off outside the office of the Federal Investigation Agency. The southwest is expected to take the brunt of the stormy weather again today, says the Environment Agency. Late into the night, firefighters were pumping out flood water left by high seas in Perranporth in Cornwall. We have a full report from the county later on Guardian Daily. The governor of New York State in the USA is facing calls for his resignation. Elliot Spitzer, who called himself Mr. Clean, was forced to apologise on television after being caught hiring a prostitute. A police investigation revealed Mr. Spitzer's involvement. School children should be involved in citizenship ceremonies, a report is expected to say today. The former Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, will make recommendations to strengthen the significance of citizenship. He's believed to recommend that school leavers should swear allegiance to the Queen and the law of the country. Nine suspected illegal immigrants have disappeared after police allowed them to make their own way to a detention centre. They were found last month hiding in a lorry near Ely in Cambridgeshire. After waiting in vain for immigration officers, police say they were forced to put the nine suspected Afghans on a train to London. All the papers carry full stories of the bad weather across Britain. The Times has a front page picture of a man actually flying through the air with his umbrella across Bournemouth Beach. The Sun's shock shot is of a dad pushing his baby's buggy into the path of a giant wave. The Mail claims tomorrow's budget will include a warning to supermarkets to reduce the number of plastic bags they give out or face a ban. And The Guardian believes the government will not restrict the power of the Attorney General to stop prosecutions, even in cases of political controversy. More on the day's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Questions are being asked today about why spending on wars has risen so steeply despite a reduction in troop numbers in Iraq. The Commons Defence Committee forecast the operational costs of more than £3 billion for this financial year, a 94% increase on last year's total of £1.7 billion. The chair of the Commons Defence Committee, James Arbuthnot, has asked the Ministry of Defence for a much clearer picture of what exactly the money's being spent on.
Well, we don't begrudge the armed forces the money at all. The armed forces deserve to be properly funded. They deserve the proper equipment and to be protected and to be given bonuses and to be properly manned. All of that, we have no objection to that. What we do find surprising is that in the last 3 months, the cost of operations in Afghanistan has gone up by 50%. According to the predictions. That may not be actually that surprising because of the intensity of operations and because of the fact that the number of troops have gone up. But in Iraq, the cost has gone up by 50% in the last 3 months as well. And that's at a time when we're meant to be drawing our troops down. So we find that particularly surprising, and we think that the Ministry of Defence should take very great care in giving us some proper explanations of it.
So you've gone back to them, have you, and said that you need a lot more information about why this is happening?
Yes, that's what our report says, that when there is an increase like that in over a three-month period, we should have proper explanation, and the Ministry of Defence should not take the House of Commons for granted in the sort of money that it's expecting.
It's remarkable that there's a doubling of money being spent on these wars, but still we hear stories of equipment shortages.
Yes, it is. In a sense, the doubling of the money is the overall amount that is being spent, predicted to be spent this year, compared with the amount that was actually spent last year. But perhaps it's not so surprising that there are equipment shortages, given that the whole of the Western world, at the end of the Cold War, seemed to take the view that defence was no longer an issue, and many, many countries reduced defence spending. We have reduced defence spending in terms of the proportion of gross domestic product that we're putting towards defence. And yet the world is a much less certain place, and we ought to be increasing defence spending. We ought to give more priority to the armed forces. This is part of the parliamentary scrutiny that any department has to go through. And so this process of our demanding better explanation is part of the accountability to the people of the Ministry of Defence, and it's a right and proper process that the Ministry of Defence has got to go through. And if they do get hauled over the coals for not explaining things properly when they're asking for £1 billion more of the people's money, then I hope they will do better next time.
Now batten down the hatches, weather forecasters warn that more high winds and heavy rain will batter parts of Britain again today. Roads, rail and air travel have all been hit, not to mention the 12,000 homes left without power and the many of them that have been flooded. The damage has mainly affected homes in southwest England. The Guardian's Stephen Morris sent this report from the fishing port of Loo on the north coast of Cornwall.
Yes, well, it's made a bit of a mess down here. The surge of water up the rivers has meant that lots of the low-lying rail lines have been swamped by water, so that they're running things like coach services, and in some cases people are just making other arrangements trying to drive through this floodwater. If you do go 100 yards from where I'm standing now, the waves are still crashing onto the beaches, and people are going and having a look. It's hard to resist, really, but the Coast Guard is saying that's very dangerous, please stay away. They were actually quite lucky here because the wind dropped just as the high tide came up.
Well, while the residents of Cornwall defend their homes with sandbags for a second day, many will be thinking that the storms are a result of climate change. But they could be wrong. A new study looking at the severe floods which hit central England last year has found the flooding had no link to climate change whatsoever. The report can be read in the International Journal of Climatology. Here's the author, Jamie Hannaford, talking to The Guardian's science correspondent, James Randerson.
The main conclusion from our reports on the 2007 floods is that they were completely unprecedented, certainly in terms of summer rainfall. People who generally associate the winter with being the flood season in the UK do see a lot of winter flooding in most winters in one area or another of the UK. But this kind of summer flooding is certainly unprecedented. And first of all, if you look at the rainfall over a long period, May to July period, then if we aggregate the rainfall over that period, then that's the wettest in the entire England and Wales rainfall record going back to 1766. So that's quite staggering. Really, that is, being that it's the wettest over such a long period of several centuries. And certainly, if we look at the individual extreme rainfalls within that, then we did see some really notable rainfall extremes in terms of return periods of 100, 200 years. And also, in terms of the river flows, when we've looked at the river flow records, which are typically much shorter, might only be the last 30 or 40 years or so, but generally they do show return periods of sometimes between 100 and 200 years. So these are very rare events, there's no doubt about it.
Scientists are always very careful to say, you know, we can't link any one particular event to climate change. But there was a lot of speculation last year that those kind of very extreme events might become more common because of increased variability in the climate linked to climate change. You've looked at some of the trends. Does this event fall into a sort of pattern that could be linked to climate change?
As you say, there was a lot of speculation that this is a manifestation of climate change occurring already. Well, certainly on the basis of a lot of research we've undertaken at the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology, we certainly wouldn't say that it's an established part of a long-term trend. First of all, much of the work that we've done, where we've been looking at trends over the last 30 or 40 years or so, which is when most river flow records extend from, generally we see, although we can identify trends, they tend to be in the northern and western areas of the UK, the upland areas and more maritime-influenced areas. And also, they tend to be winter trends, so in effect driven by increases in winter rainfall, which we have associated with some more climatic variability rather than necessarily climatic change. So the 2007 floods were kind of out of kilter in, first of all, in the season in which they occurred, but also the location in which they've occurred doesn't really seem to fit in with any established trends that we've picked up on through our research.
So to sort of summarise the trend that might be happening, and who knows whether it's linked to climate change or not, it's for increased winter rainfall perhaps decreased summer rainfall, but at the moment the data just, well, there isn't enough data to be sure that that really is a trend or just part of natural variability.
Yeah, I think that's very well put, actually. We do, whilst we see some tendencies, so we certainly see a tendency towards more a well-established increase in winter rainfall, and to a certain extent in some areas in the UK, a decrease in summer rainfall, we can't really attribute that to any long-term climatic-driven trend. We can match up some of the winter rainfall trends to some modes of climatic variability, but certainly not what we would call a long-term climatic-driven trend. That doesn't mean to say that climate change isn't happening. We can't categorically say that it's not happening because, of course, as you say, we have limitations of the days, so we have short records, and also climatic change is generally regarded, certainly from the temperature point of view, where the evidence is less ambiguous. You do have an increasing temperature trend, but that's generally been in the very recent past. So it might, you know, it may take more time for these signals to emerge. It may take more time for the signal of climate change to actually get out of the noise of natural variability.
Other things on the Guardian website today: what can British policymakers learn from childcare in Sweden? That's on societyguardian.co.uk. On our Comment is Free blog, Chris Ames puts his case for why the British government needs to be harsher on Saudi Arabia. Plus, there's all the latest news and tips on the first day of the Cheltenham Festival. That's on guardian.co.uk/sport, where you can also follow minute-by-minute coverage of Inter Milan versus Liverpool tonight from 7:30. Next now to Spain, where the country's Prime Minister can relax a little now, having just been voted in for a second term in office. José Zapatero's Socialist Workers' Party won 44% of the vote after a campaign thrown into turmoil at the last minute by the killing of a politician blamed on Basque separatist ETA. Paul Hamelos is in Madrid for The Guardian. I spoke to him earlier and began by asking whether the result was a clear endorsement for Zapatero.
Well, it is, because although it wasn't the absolute majority that he probably would have wanted, it was nonetheless, they gained 43% of a 75% turnout. And I don't think anybody would turn their noses up at that.
Do you think that he can now then be rid of his tag as the accidental PM, they call him, don't they?
Well, that's right, yes. I mean, he came to power in 2004, shortly after the Madrid train bombings, you know, as a result of manipulation by the then governing People's Party. And for a long time, people have suggested that he wasn't really a valid prime minister. Well, after his victory in this general election, so I think he can throw that tag off.
So what does this now mean then for his opponent?
Well, Mariano Rajoy, having been defeated twice, will doubtless face calls for him to resign. But successions are traditionally very difficult in Spanish political parties. There's always a lot of kind of internal debates going on. And the People's Party, this election presented itself as a very right-wing opposition, really hitting home on immigration as one of the big topics that it ran on. And it's now up to the sort of party big bosses to decide whether they want to go for more centrist vote.
Now, European leaders all face tough decisions as the credit squeeze takes hold. How well placed is the socialist government in Spain to meet these economic challenges?
Well, they would say that they're very well placed because they've got a record budget surplus of 2%, which they argue will allow them to bring in a load of fiscal incentives to kind of stimulate the economy. And some analysts suggest that, you know, Spain is a much more modern, flexible economy. It's got multinationals with interests abroad, and that it's better prepared than ever to deal with a global recession. Although there are others who argue that actually growth is going to slow down considerably, possibly dropping to 2% from a previous average of 4, and that does risk bringing on a recession. And of course, one of the things that's been most heavily hit by the global credit squeeze has been the construction industry, for which for a long time was the sort of motor of Spain's quite spectacular growth over the last decade. So it'll be very interesting to see how this plays up in the next 4 years.
What changes has Zapatero enacted in Spain in the last 4 years then?
Well, he's known really as the kind of liberal reforming prime minister. He legalized gay marriage. He brought in gender equality laws. He passed a quite controversial, what was called the historical memory law, which tried to kind of redress some of the grievances of the Republicans who suffered under the former dictator General Franco. And now it looks like he's going to try and push on with some of these social reforms, because he certainly sees himself as in the kind of vanguard of modern European liberals.
The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson on guardian.co.uk.
Barely have you finished rounding up one week of action, then another one goes and happens. Football Weekly. In today's show, what did Chelsea, Man United and a used teabag have in common? They're all out of the cup and a bit bitter. As football's oldest competition reels from an especially historic round of action, we salute the giant killers. And elsewhere, we get the latest from the Premier League. Fresh word from Spain and Italy, and something tasty from the top of the French table, with a bit of Bordeaux. There's your posts, and we look forward to the busy week of action that awaits in Europe, into Liverpool, and sundry UEFA delights. All that in Football Weekly.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Still to come on Guardian Daily, why the new fancy HD TV technology could soon lose some of its shine. But first, the number of people put to death in China has dropped. No official government figures have been released, but with just under 6 weeks to go before the Beijing Olympics, it's hard to not be slightly suspicious about the news. Capital punishment is used in China for many crimes, ranging from tax evasion, corruption and racketeering to murder. Here's our Beijing correspondent Tanya Brannigan.
2 years ago, the authorities here introduced a package of reforms which they described as kill fewer, kill carefully, partly because there'd been quite a lot of public disquiet at a spate of miscarriages of justice. And the aim was really to bring down the use of the death penalty quite dramatically. We don't know exactly how many people China executes, because it's a state secret, but we do know that even on reported cases, it executes more people annually than the rest of the world combined.
What sort of crimes are punishable by death there?
It's a huge range of crimes that still carry the death penalty here, over 60 in fact, and many of those are non-violent, so drug smuggling, corruption, even damaging or destroying state treasures, which apparently includes killing pandas. Is potentially punishable with the death penalty. But what the experts here say is that if you actually look at how the law is being used, that it's now being used far less frequently in those non-violent cases, and that it really does seem as if the death penalty is being used much more in violent, serious crime cases now.
Do you think then that this is the government cleaning up its act in the wake of the Olympics soon to be there?
There are a lot of people here, and that includes officials as well as academics and as well as lawyers, who want to see the system improve, who want to see it do a better job for ordinary people, and who know that that's going to mean really sort of substantial legal reforms. Now, people would also say this is one step forward, but there's a long way to go. And so even people here who are pressing for reform say it's not yet time to rule out the death penalty necessarily. It's more about really scaling back its use. Similarly, people would also say that there's a really desperate need for an improvement in the judicial system in terms of the way courts handle cases. A lot of human rights groups warn that confessions, for example, can be used even when they've been obtained under duress or even torture, that there's a lack of access to lawyers, that lawyers here don't have enough protections themselves. So there's a lot of room for improvement, but there is also, I think, a genuine will for change.
Tanya Brannigan there in Beijing.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Now, do you have a high-definition TV? Well, sales have been soaring on the promise that it offers a much sharper screen, giving a clearer and better overall picture. However, there's a new kid on the block now that's threatening to make HD TV redundant. Here's The Guardian's media correspondent, Owen Gibson, with the details.
They've been working on this in Japan for some time, and they've been working in conjunction with the BBC, a broadcaster called NHK, which is the Japanese equivalent of the BBC, are working on this technology called Super High Vision, which is the next version, if you like, of HD TV, which has only just recently been introduced in this country. I mean, you don't need to be too quick to junk your existing HD TV set yet, because they're planning to introduce it for 2025. But they've already got sort of prototypes out in Japan, and one of our reporters, Jamie Carter, has been out there to see it, and the BBC are hoping to use this to show the 2012 Olympics in, you know, stunningly realistic detail on big screens in town centres, basically, come the time of the Olympics.
And so Jamie's seen it firsthand. What did he say about it?
He said it was stunning, really. You know, he said it was, you're sort of sat inches away from this 450-inch screen, you've got these, you know, concert hall quality speakers. And he said, you know, there was oohs and ahs and gasps at every single turn. But once you start digging into the technology behind it, you start to realise what a challenge it will be to sort of see this stuff on our TV screens, because such is the depth of the quality, the size of the file, if you like, the information is so large that normal transmission technology can't handle it at the moment. So they're working with the BBC to find ways of compressing it down so it can be sent over normal airways.
So consumers that have gone out and bought a HD TV, they don't have to worry too much yet?
No, well, obviously the onward march of technology moves on ever quicker, but you know, you don't need to worry about junking your new 32-inch plasma screen just yet. I mean, I think you've got another 20-odd years before you need to do that.
It's tough, isn't it, for consumers? They're constantly faced with new inventions, new technology coming in. You can go out and buy a laptop today, and you know, within 6 months it can be out of date.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, and as I say, the cycle seems to be getting ever quicker, and you're always worried that technology has been foisted on you rather than consumers actually genuinely wanting it. But I mean, I guess that's the way the technology industry has always worked. They've always innovated, tried new things, and the ones that catch on will be the ones that consumers really find a use for and love, like the iPod or DVD. We've recently seen a war in high definition DVDs where Toshiba went up against Sony, and the people who bought these Toshiba players and DVDs are already kind of theirs have been consigned to the dustbin within a year. So you're right, I mean, it's quite confusing, I think, for consumers. Increasingly difficult to pick the winners, if you like.
Owen Gibson there. The producers on Guardian Daily were Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm Mel Preen. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.